On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Someday, we'll have a week of sunshine and flowers to review on Friday, but I'm afraid it's not this one. On the home stretch to midterm elections, the top U.S. military spokesman in Iraq says the much-touted American-Iraqi security crackdown in the capital has failed. Death tolls, Iraqi and American, are spiraling, a jihadi Tet offensive, Tom Friedman calls it. In North Asia, the noose on North Korea's nukes looks hard to tighten. In the political trenches, GOP conservatives are going at each other, with born-again Dick Armey calling Christian right leaders bullies and thugs. Joining me today from Washington is Ann Kornblut, national correspondent for The New York Times. She's been on the campaign trail in Iowa, Connecticut, New York. Right after this conversation, is headed today to Rochester, New York, to cover Hillary Clinton's Senate debate. Ann, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Also with us from Washington, David Ignatius, columnist and associate editor at The Washington Post. He's been looking at coup rumors in Iraq and who wins how in American politics. David Ignatius, great to have you.
Hi, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you here.
Hello, Tom, Ann, and David.
So there's a very full table of news on many fronts this week. Ann Kornblut, to pick your top headline for us, where do you dive in?
Well, you're right. There's just so much going on right now. I would say that the poll numbers really have been dominating the conversation here for me this week, at least. A lot of both Democrats and Republicans that I've been talking to have said that they really think it's turned a corner, that for all the hopefulness Democrats had before they'd take back either the House or the Senate, they really think they've passed the point of no return. You've seen 15 percentage point approval ratings for the Republican Congress. Yeah. The Mark Foley scandal in a number of races has at least tipped the scales, if not actually changing the dynamic of the race. And both Republicans and Democrats say that there are a larger number of races in play, at least in the House side, than they had initially anticipated.
So the world rocking in a lot of directions. People have been saying for weeks now the House may go Democrat. The Senate, how are you calling that now, Ann?
I'm not calling anything at this point.
Okay.
I would say that there are about six or seven races in play, and with six of them all being all that's needed to tip the balance, it's going to be a close call. There seems to be a consensus. I actually don't have an opinion on what will happen, but there seems to be a consensus that the House is likelier than the Senate. But again, it could happen in the Senate too.
David Ignatius, there's almost too much to pick from this week. But what's at the top of your screen as you look out on all this news and behind it?
Well, it's a grim week. I think we may look back on this as the week or one of them when the wheels really did finally come off the Bush administration's Iraq policy, when you have the usually upbeat general in Baghdad, who's the spokesman for the U.S. military, admitting that our much ballyhooed Baghdad stabilization effort is failing. When you have the president himself, I'm told in private conversations with Republican members of the Congress saying that changes are going to be made in U.S. policy. The talk that we've been hearing up until very recently of stay the course with the president literally calling the Democrats the party of cut and run, I think that period is over. And what comes next, we're all speculating about. A lot of people are watching very carefully the former Secretary of State, James Baker, close to the Bush family, who has already talked to Iranian officials, Syrian officials, something that nobody in the Bush administration has done, about finding ways to stabilize the situation in Iraq. I think the one thing we can say for sure is that after the election, we will see changes in this policy.
Let's hear that bit. It was from General William Caldwell in Baghdad this week, saying that the two-month and nearly more U.S.-Iraqi military operation to stem sectarian bloodshed and attacks in Baghdad has fallen short.
Operation Together Forward has made a difference in the focus areas, but has not met our overall expectations of sustaining a reduction in the levels of violence.
Disheartening, he called it. Jack Beatty, what's at the top of your list this week?
Well, I've got Ohio on my mind. Events there could influence the future of American politics more than any other state. Ohio has been, with Indiana, the Republican beachhead in the North. There is undergoing there a realignment, at least in this election, to the Democrats. The question is, how far will it go? There are as many as five vulnerable House Republicans. Senator Mike DeWine is way back in the polls against his challenger, Sherrod Brown. And the gubernatorial candidate with the Democrats looks like he's going to win in a walk. The question is, will this last? If it does last, it really is a significant development because, you know, people think that if any Democrat can take the states that Kerry took in 2004. Well, if you add Ohio to them, of course, the Democrat wins. And the Republicans have won now two presidential elections in a row counting on Ohio. If that tilts away from them, that influences the entire electoral map. And things aren't going well in Indiana, their other beachhead in the north. Three congressional seats in dire peril there. One guy behind, an incumbent behind 23 points. The Republican governor, Mitch Daniels, very unpopular there. If the Republicans get stuck in the South, then you look at their electoral map, and it is the map of William Jennings Bryan. It is really rural America and the South. And that was the election of 1896. And you don't want to get stuck there as a party because you just can't be competitive unless you can break out of that.
I want to come back to politics, but take a look at this Iraq business. The news just keeps coming this week. President Bush talking about it, Donald Rumsfeld talking about it, of course, the general in Baghdad. Here was President Bush pressed by ABC's George Stephanopoulos about the high number of U.S. casualties in Iraq. President Bush said casualties are not how he's measuring the war's success or failure.
If that's the definition of success or failure, the number of casualties, then you're right. But that's what the enemy knows. See, they try to define success or failure. I define success or failure as to whether or not the Iraqis will be able to defend themselves. I define success or failure as whether the unity government is making difficult decisions necessary to unite the country.
In that same interview, Bush said New York Times columnist Tom Friedman could be right when he compared the surge in violence in Iraq and the Tet Offensive, a turning point in the Vietnam War.
He could be right. There's certainly a stepped-up level of violence, and we're heading into an election.
But Donald Rumsfeld, defense secretary, this week advised patience. He said Iraq's new government has been in office less than 5 months.
That's less than a baseball season. Think of that. We're impatient. I'm impatient. Everyone's impatient.
David Ignatius, here's quite a range from Tet Offensive, you know, wheels coming off, as you say, to patience. It's a young government, that more of the stick with it line. We had Dick Cheney saying this week to Time magazine, I know what the president thinks. I know what I think. And we're not looking for an exit strategy. We're looking for victory. Make some sense of this picture. What's actually going on behind the grim news and this sort of, you know, alternating rhythm of stay the course or no, we've really got to change here, David?
Well, I think the administration is rattled. I think they had believed that the Baghdad stabilization effort would succeed. I was in Baghdad most recently in August, traveling with General Abizaid, the commander of CENTCOM, was the overall military commander, and we were out in the neighborhoods where U.S. troops had poured in, and we found that compared to what they'd been a few weeks before, they were stabilized. The problem that was obvious then was once the U.S. troops pull back, the Iraqi security forces, the army and the police, simply are not able to maintain order. And that's what we're seeing around the country. And I think that there's been a recognition that we really are caught now in a civil war. People have been mincing words about that for a year. And I think, with violence exploding all over the country, we have a report today that the Shiite militia of Muqtada Sadr has just stormed into control of the capital of Maysan province,
a place that
is usually touted as being very secure. I think there's a sense that it's just really spinning out of control, that Maliki, the prime minister we pushed very hard to install, who has nominally on paper a national unity government and all sorts of good plans that are worked out in the green zone, that none of this is connecting with what's happening on the ground in the real world of Iraq, the red zone.
And Kornblut, on the ground in America, is that moving people's votes, or are Republican voters just hunkering down? They may not know what's going to happen in Iraq, but they don't want to jump away from their man, Bush.
That had been the dynamic previous to this. I would say that at least the pollsters I've spoken to, and again, I'm not going to call the election now, but it seems to be that Iraq is the underpinning of the entire election at this point. That until the point when people thought there was no longer a purpose in Iraq, they were willing to stay with President Bush. But over the last 2 months, there's been a significant shift where when the casualties have risen, people no longer seem to see why exactly we're there. And increasingly, as David says, and it's clear to people back home that it is a civil war. They've no longer understood why they're sustaining those kinds of casualties. And the Vietnam War analogy is obviously very troublesome for the Bush administration on a number of different levels. But I would say primarily their argument that they want to take the long view, that history will judge them, is not working in their favor anymore.
I want to turn to North Korea. President Bush stressed this week that the United States isn't going it alone on North Korea and called for coordinated pushback on Pyongyang's nuclear testing.
I know that if more than one nation is admonishing North Korea, it is more likely the leader in North Korea will make a rational decision.
Of course, the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, was out in the region trying to reinforce the president's position. Here she is in Seoul, South Korea, saying all nations that backed the UN resolution have an obligation to aggressively monitor North Korea's trade and nuclear program.
The key is to live up to the obligation that all of us undertook, that North Korea should not be able to traffic in these weapons and weapons technologies.
All right, David Ignatius, it seems like we've got red lines crossed all over the place here. They've tested a nuke. They've said we hear they could do another, though they're telling China now they won't. Kim Jong-il says he's sorry. Does that mean anything? And is Condoleezza Rice getting the support in Asia that she and the world need to get this genie back in the bottle or at least under some kind of control?
We'll have to see what the outcome of Condoleezza Rice's trip to Asia is. And I think in terms of getting the genie back in the bottle, meaning getting North Korea to give up nuclear weapons entirely, you'd have to say that's unlikely. What I've been struck by this week is the series of role reversals. We have Bush becoming Mr. Diplomacy. He speaks at every opportunity about the need for diplomacy to work. We have the Chinese getting tough, at least by Chinese standards, saying that they will inspect cargoes passing across the frontier from North Korea and hinting in the last 24 hours that they might use stronger measures, cutting off some oil supplies to North Korea if the North Koreans test it again. Meanwhile, we have this unlikely spectacle of Kim Jong-il saying he's sorry, and we have Rice insisting again and again, we have no intention to invade North Korea, we want to continue talks with North Korea. All these elements seem to me to suggest that we're heading, if the Chinese really do keep up the pressure, toward a renewal of diplomacy with North Korea, and I think that's in part because the international community was very united in its anger at the North Korean test.
But diplomacy toward what? You're saying, I hear you saying you don't see North Korea giving up its nuclear program, so what's on the table?
I think that a freeze in the North Korean program, a verifiable monitoring of the status of North Korea's program, and most important of all, verifiable controls on any ability by North Korea to export either technology, fissile material, or a bomb itself. I think those would be the elements of a settlement.
Ann Kornblut, what about North Korea on the political front? Is that one filtering through? Can you feel it yet? Is it too new?
Well, of course, there's nothing that can't be seen through the political prism, including this. It hasn't shown up in any of the polls that I saw this week. But what you have seen is this interesting dialogue now, or debate, really, between former President Clinton and the current President Bush, as well as Senator Hillary Clinton and John McCain, arguing over who's to blame here. You've seen Republicans really taking the Clinton administration to task for letting North Korea enter an agreement and then not stick by their words originally. This past week, I went and saw former President Clinton at Georgetown University give a big speech about the common good, looking back at his administration and the work it did and trying to put it into a framework. And in that, he talked primarily about domestic issues. But when he talked about North Korea, he really took the administration to task. So I'm not sure it's filtering through. I don't think we haven't seen any ads, for example, talking about North Korea, launching a missile to the West Coast. But I do think as a subtext for whether the Bush administration has handled diplomacy well, it is there, and it's part of the Democratic effort to, for the first time in many generations, really take the to make foreign policy a strength rather than a weakness.
Jack Meade, do you see the GOP beginning an effective regrouping of some kind here? We talked with Jim Baker last week with the Iraq Study Group. Of course, that's bipartisan, but there may be a path for the president here toward a different strategy in Iraq. On the other hand, we've got the Ann's paper, the Times, reporting today all kinds of bitter bickering within the right now. Dick Armey calling James Dobson and his Christian right group bullies and thugs. Is there a regrouping, a kind of a recalibration, or still a falling apart?
I think there's a preliminary falling apart. The falling apart before the November election, when the you know, things will really get serious. It's very hard. The 16% of Americans who have a low opinion of this Republican Congress are right. It deserves a low opinion. It's just hard to come to any other conclusion with the metastasizing ethical scandals, with the sellouts. I shouldn't even say sellouts. With the purchase of by bills of every special interest in the country, with the indifference, complete indifference to public opinion, and that this Congress seems to have manifested, seen in paradigm fashion, and Speaker Hastert. We didn't have to pay attention to that. These messages, you know, 54-year-old guy writing a 16-year-old kid, happens all the time. You can't act like that, like an establishment, as if you're kings and get away with it. And they're not going to get away with it in November. I mean, the House isn't. Republicans are now conceding the House privately. So, I don't think they're going to regroup, or before they regroup, they're going to have a fantastic civil war over Iraq and over the balance between economic issues and social issues, and it's going to be the circular firing squad we saw on Capitol Hill after the announcement of Foley's lapse.
And yet, with all these really serious challenges around the world, you can't help but think that Americans don't want things to fall apart too much here. Let's listen to our listeners on this. Michael's calling from Brockton, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Just want to make two points. It's amazing. 50 years later, after Vietnam and the war on communism, we're now faced in the same predicament. We have a war on terrorism that has led us into Iraq, and we're once again in a mess. We need to open our eyes to history and learn from our previous mistakes. My second point, Tom, is we as a nation need to take responsibility for destabilizing the Middle East. Iraq was a stable country. Saddam Hussein, horrible leader, we know that, but it was stable. We have now made the situation worse by destabilizing Iraq. We need to take action, admit to our mistakes, and work closely.
But Michael, are you just saying, come home, America? I mean, 9/11 did happen. It's not as though the world was paradise before the invasion of Iraq.
Yeah, we do need some sort of exit strategy. This claim that, you know, by leaving is not victory and we need to stay the course. You know, obviously it's not working. We need to learn the lessons we learned in Vietnam and apply them in today's era.
Clearly not working with you. Let's take another call from Columbia, South Carolina. Patrick, you're on the air.
Well, I agree with your previous caller in one point, and that is we need to learn from history. Right now we've got a situation where the government and the people are not united. A disunity government, a disunity people. That is the problem on Iraq, but it is not the Iraqi government and the Iraqi people. It's the American government and the American people that are causing the enemies to be emboldened.
But where should the American people unify? Around what perspective or policy, in your view, Patrick?
Well, I think, you know, we have a president. We elected a president, and that president has set a course, an agenda for winning the war. But rather than that, there is a political angle that is being taken by the Democrats. And how this is news this week is it's happening right on your show right now. You've got people on your show right now, your reporters,
yep,
who are absolutely giddy at the Republicans who are backing off from supporting Bush.
You know, I don't know if I hear exactly giddiness, but David Ignatian is saying that it looks as though the wheels are coming off our strategy in Iraq. Do you not see the trouble there, Patrick?
The trouble is that we have you can't win a war ever if the people are divided, and our nation is divided. You can't win this war until the people of America are united. And there's, for political gain, you almost get the idea that the Democrats would be happy to see us lose this
war. But what if there were unity behind a policy that can't work?
Why is it a policy that can't work?
Well, I mean, I can answer that, but I do see what's happening in Iraq. But we've got your perspective, Patrick, and we appreciate your call. You know, I want to take this and turn it into a campaign that you've been following, Ann, and many others as well, in Connecticut. Of course, Joe Lieberman there up against the anti-war candidate Ned Lamont. And their debate this week may lay some of this, exactly this kind of conversation, out in front of us. Let's listen to just a little bit of it. There are five Connecticut senatorial candidates debating on Wednesday at the Bushnell Center for the Performing Arts in Hartford, Connecticut. Let's start right in there with incumbent Senator Joseph Lieberman, who, of course, is now running as an independent, though he's been a Democrat for years. He had this to say about the way forward in Iraq.
That's why I recently, again, issued a 10-point plan to get the job done there, including the removal of Donald Rumsfeld as Secretary of Defense and specific new ideas for better training Iraqi forces so we can bring our troops home. We've got to end the war in Iraq, but we've got to do it in the right way that
Mr.
does not
Schlesinger.
Compromise our security.
Out with Rumsfeld, but end it in the right way, says Joe Lieberman. Then there's the Republican challenger, Alan Schlesinger, praising the military.
You know, on Iraq, the military, our mighty military of America, has done such an outstanding job. They have done everything that they have been asked to do. No one can second guess what we have done and what the generals have done over there. The problem in Iraq is not military. The problem in Iraq is political.
Of course, the generals, in a way, are second-guessing their own policy this week, saying the Baghdad initiative has not worked out. Then Democratic nominee anti-war Ned Lamont spoke critically about the situation in Iraq.
Over the last 3.5 years, there have been a number of attempts to change the course, make sure that the Maliki government has all the necessary incentives to stand up and take responsibility for their own destiny. And along the way, Senator Lieberman has opposed all attempts to change the course. And here we are 3.5 years later with 140,000 of our bravest troops stuck in the middle of a bloody civil war. Colin Powell recently said, we've got to change course. Every course must have an end.
Ann Kornblut, you've been paying close attention to this Connecticut race. What can we learn from the debate in Connecticut about this, the contemplation of this crisis in Iraq that Americans are in the midst of right now?
Well, I would point out that Schlesinger, the Republican candidate that we just heard from, has been in the single digits. I don't know that that's reflective of the entire nation, but in a way, Joe Lieberman has diffused the debate from the primary. He has done what he would not do during the primary, or at least the early days of the primary, which is to criticize, to focus on his criticism of the Bush administration and the war, and to talk about the eventual departure. He's not – Ned Lamont would pull troops out before Joe Lieberman would. But they are essentially on the same page. It's just a matter of timing. And that's a pretty significant shift. And I would expect that we'd see it have a pretty large impact on the Democratic presidential primary starting next year.
When Ned Lamont says, let's get out, and Joe Lieberman says, let's get out right, is it clear how far apart they are in timing or in circumstances under which they would approve of an exit?
Joe Lieberman has not set a specific date. He has talked, as other Democrats have, about a phased redeployment. Ned Lamont would do it much more quickly.
French is calling from Mystic, Connecticut. Hi, French, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was just wanting to comment about the Lieberman-Lamont situation. I just believe that what we've seen today with the most recent, I think it was Quinnipiac poll that was out, he's actually pulled ahead further.
That's Joe Lieberman in the lead, you're saying. Mm-hmm.
And I think what's happening is that Ned Lamont's one topic, race, is no longer resonating. And that people are more voting, or the polls show they're more supporting Lieberman on his seniority in the Senate, and what clout that actually holds.
Let me ask you, French, why would Lamont's line on Iraq, his very critical line in Iraq, not resonate more in a week when Iraq is looking so difficult? What's your take on that?
I just believe that he's failed to provide an alternative. I mean, it's one thing just to criticize the opposition, but without having any forward-moving agenda, you know, it just doesn't resonate. You can criticize for so long, but then you have to show that you have some alternative. And he hasn't really presented an alternative, and just to be the counter position is not holding. Maybe with the base, it's, you know, eliciting a lot of support, but what's happening here is the Republicans are now siding over with Joe Lieberman, give him that extra edge.
Mm-hmm. Lieberman hanging in there in the election that counts, the one that sends somebody to Washington. French, thanks for your call. Let's get another from Rebecca in Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Rebecca. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
There's a smaller story this week that I think has really big symbolic significance, and that's David Kuo's revelations about the President's Office of Faith-Based Initiatives, because I think it could symbolize an unraveling of the Republican Party's control over large segments of the American Christian population.
This is the deputy director of that program who came out very disillusioned now with a book saying the Christian right's been betrayed by the Bush administration.
Right. And so if there's a shift in the relationship between the Christian right and the Republican Party that report symbolizes, I think that could be really significant, both for the upcoming election and the Republicans' long-term ability to implement a lot of the policies that are underlying the big stories we're talking about this week.
Rebecca, let me put that to our panel. David Ignatius, how about it? The coalition there within the GOP, tough words between Dick Armey and James Dobson's group reported just today. What about David Kuo, the critique, the unity on that front?
Well, I think the Republican crack-up is one of the big stories we're seeing, and I think, as Jack Beatty suggested earlier, it'll get worse after the reversals that are almost certain to come in the November elections. We saw signs of it over the past year. The president was simply unable to hold the Republicans in the Congress on key legislative proposals. He could not hold House Republicans on the immigration issue. They defected, thinking that his fairly moderate proposals were unacceptable. He couldn't hold the Senate Republicans on the interrogation torture issue. McCain took the center away from him. And, I think that more broadly we can see that the Republicans is so strong, holding the White House and both legislative branches, have not been able during the last 6 years to become the nation's governing party. They just couldn't do it. The politics of Karl Rove, the politics of playing to the base, of division, if you will, prevented them from moving to the center and speaking to the whole country. And I think that's really what's cracking up.
Mm-hmm. We're looking at a week in the news with our news roundtable this hour. Ann Kornblut of the New York Times, and David Ignatius of the Washington Post. Jack Beatty's here. What do you see out there? The president's campaigning on tough interrogation, wiretapping, and stay the course. Is that selling at your house? And how about that Barack Obama? Is Time magazine right? Is this the next president? The quote on the cover of Time this week. You know, it's not just candidates, what they say, that has an impact on voters. Campaign ads have a big impact. In Pennsylvania, incumbent Republican Congressman Don Sherwood is in trouble. The race could turn on how voters respond to events in his personal life. He's confessed to cheating on his wife. His alleged mistress dialed 911 and claimed Sherwood tried to choke her. Sherwood issued this apology ad.
I made a mistake that nearly cost me the love of my wife, Carol, and our daughters. As a family, we've worked through this. Because of my deep regret, our love, and the fact that the allegation of abuse was never true.
Sherwood's challenger, Democrat Chris Carney, hit the airwaves with an ad that challenged the Sherwood family values stature.
Don Sherwood's mistress made a 911 call alleging that he had choked her.
Don Sherwood campaigned on family values. He has no family values.
I'm a lifelong.
Values, family values, and right on down the line, Jack Beatty, that has been a tough drum to beat between Mark Foley and all the rest, including there on Don Sherwood, where President Bush went out to help him.
Yeah, hypocrisy is I mean, voters can't stand it. You know, here's a 65-year-old man. The mistress was 29. She said, you know, Don, the rest of the guys down here, they just kind of smooth. Don came in town in that pickup truck and everything, and he was just a real man. That's what she liked him a lot until she says it really wasn't strangling. It was a vigorous massage. That's the way he put it. And this kind of thing, the hypocrisy charge is going around, and it's taken, and it's part of what our caller from Arlington was saying, the feeling on the part of the religious right that these people aren't righteous, many of these politicians, because many politicians aren't righteous. But that feeling of betrayal, on these moral matters really matters to religious conservatives. They don't only want to change politics. They want to change the culture. They want people to act better. And, you know, in Ohio, I go back to Ohio, look what's happening there. Bush got 76% of evangelical voters in 2004. That's really why he carried the state. Now the gubernatorial candidate out there, Blackwell, is getting 45%. The Democrat, Strickland, 44%. An incredible erosion of support that may be, you know, taking out some of these complaints about the Republican leadership and about the decay in values and standards on Republican candidates.
Ann Kornblut, you mentioned Bill Clinton's speech on the common good. Here we see the Republican values plank being buffeted by this headline after headline here. But how does that work? Does that just leave some of the Republican base at home? Do the Democrats appear to be stepping forward with a values message of their own that you see working on the hustings?
Well, there's a difference of opinion here. There are Republicans who fear that it will simply suppress turnout and that Republicans will stay home, as you suggest. I will say that referring back to the Sherwood ad, you know it's a terrible sign when in your campaign you have to say the allegation of abuse was never true. but Democrats see this as an opening for them to reclaim some of the to take back some of the gains that Bush made when he used compassionate conservative. The common good is really an attempt to counter that. On both values and national security, they think they can at least even out the playing field, if not reclaim some of the mantle for themselves.
And David Ignatius, you've been looking at Mark Halperin and John Harris's work recently. They've been writing The Way to Win is their book, where they look at fundamentally different strategies for winning politically in this country. Describe those for us. And what do you see ascendant?
This is a wonderful new book by the political editors of the Washington Post, John Harris, and ABC News, Mark Halperin. And it says that beyond all the races that we're looking at this year and we'll be looking at in 2008, there's a fundamental divide in American politics between what they call Clinton politics, which imagines that America is a country with a center. Clinton's great gift was finding that center, fuzzing the edges, pulling people together, sometimes spuriously, but that Clinton hunger to be, you know, all things to all people, produced a certain kind of political synthesis. And the other kind of politics, according to this book, is the politics of George W. Bush and his key strategist, Karl Rove, which is the politics that begins with the belief that America has lost its center, that it's a deeply divided country, that people are angry over basic issues and values, and that the role of a leader is not to synthesize a la Clinton, but to clarify, which is a polite word for divide and sharpen. And I think we're seeing that theme play out in this election. And I must say, some of the people who are following the Karl Rove playbook are, in fact, on the Democratic side. The Democratic base is very angry. Ned Lamont won the Democratic primary by playing to that base, playing to all those angry Democrats. And if it's, you know, Democratic anger that turns out the vote and sweeps Republicans aside in November, we're going to have a continuation of some of the structural difficulty, I think, that makes it hard to legislate, hard to govern.
And, Kornblut, do you see evidence that we may be pulling out of that period when polarization worked like crazy? If the center was lost, do you see it coming back, whether it's coming back in the hands of a Democratic politician or in a Republican like John McCain?
I don't see it yet. I think the test will be after November 7th. There is a lot of talk among Democrats about if they win the House, how they will govern. And the consensus view, Nancy Pelosi has already said she would not pursue impeachment. And the consensus view seems to be that they would need to rein in some of their more extreme tendencies and to try and really present a moderate face in order to not only govern, but then win again in the future. So that seems to be a pull somewhat back to the middle. But again, we'll have to see, and we'll have to see what happens.
Tom, also something else going on. There's a new face to this party. It isn't the face of Al Gore and John Kerry. You know, both Harvard, Ivy League people, fine, educated, and so on, elites. It's the face of John Tester in Montana, a guy with a haircut you could land a plane on. It's that flat, who a big guy bulges out of his suits, who's a farmer. And, you know, this guy is not an elite. You don't look at him and think, oh, my gosh, does he speak French?
Don't make too much fun, Jack. I used to have a crew cut like that.
So did I. It's the face above all of Sherrod Brown in Ohio. This guy is a populist. And what is a populist? Well, really, populism is the view that economic fate finally traces back to politics. That this stuff that happens in the economy isn't just happening. It's happening because somebody, it's favoring somebody, because the fix is in, because the little guy is getting screwed. That's, in fact, a true statement, a veridical statement about much that's happening in America today. And Brown relentlessly gets at this. The middle class is going down. These trade agreements have sold us out. You, his opponent, Mike DeWine, have sold us out to the drug companies and the da-da-da. And on and on and on. That guy is a new note in the Democratic Party, talking about the downward mobility to not just industrial workers, but workers everywhere. And if that populist face catches on, that's the thing I think that could, well, it would be new for the Democratic Party, who are charged in a new book by Tom Edsel as being an elite party. You wouldn't say that about either of these guys.
If indeed that's the emerging middle ground here. Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Donald is on the line. Hi, Donald. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think by far the most important thing that happened not only this week but this past 6 years is the signing of the Military Commissions Act.
Early this week, with the president basically getting a green light from Congress to do as he wanted to do with detainees and military trials and all the rest.
Exactly. And I mean, if it's not a revoking of habeas corpus, it's a serious infringement upon it, and it's something that's fundamental to our Constitution, predating our Constitution, and it's very scary to me. It seems like we're all asleep in this.
Donald, thanks for your call. David Ignatius, there was such a ballyhoo about that a few weeks ago. This week, the bill is actually signed, and the American attention has kind of moved on. What does it leave you thinking about the civil rights and the questions Donald raising here?
Well, I think that we've moved somewhat more in the direction of lawful, orderly process as a result of the congressional debate led by John McCain. I think
did it really, somewhat, or was it protest that then kind of caved to the president?
Well, it was a compromise. Anytime you have a compromise, you know, each side is caving some. Certainly the White House gave up some of what it wanted, and it was not entirely a victory from their standpoint. I think we do need clear legal rules in this area, and we didn't have them. And you can argue that the rules that we have are unduly repressive, that they allow interrogation techniques that go beyond the line. But at least we've got rules now. It's clear that some egregious techniques are banned, and that there's a legal standard for making judgments. I think we needed that kind of foundation. Now that we've got it, we can have litigation, further political debate to refine the rules. I thought the situation before was completely unacceptable.
And what about the political resonance of this issue? The Republicans seem to have bet earlier that voters are more interested in security than in constitutional debate here. How are you reading it now that the bill's signed?
Well, that's right. And I think it's actually taken such a backseat to other events that it barely registered a blip this week on the political radar screen.
And off it went. Let's get a call from Gaithersburg, Maryland. Lewis is on the line. Hi, Lewis. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Just 2 points about Iraq, please. First is that when you're talking about the fact that we've done our job, as the president says, now it's up to the Iraqis. I think it's important to remember that we went there. This is not where we were asked to come in, like we were coming in Annam and started with advisors and all. We came to Iraq. This is our war.
So what do you take away from that? I mean, Iraqis in the end have to live and be their own country, don't they?
Right, but they didn't ask us. It was hard enough to get the Vietnamese to take part, and they wouldn't. And they knew that they would be overrun. And now we've come there, and we're not trying to win this. They're trying to keep things under control, and that's different than trying to win it. And when they keep with patrols, and they keep going in the city, and they keep getting bombed, the United States has the power to go in and win. But to do this, they're going to halfway destroy Iraq.
Yeah, the village goes to save it. Lewis, let us pick it up. David Ignatius, what about the options now? Where are the footholds here for American policy? Where might Iraq policy turn, given how bad, as military itself says, things have become?
There are two basic courses that people here in Washington are talking about. One is associated with Senator Joe Biden, the leading Democratic spokesman of foreign policy, which he calls Federalism Plus. The Iraqi Constitution calls for federalism, greater devolution of power to the regions.
The Shia, the Kurds, the Sunni would kind of be off on their own turf.
Well, you'd
sharing oil revenues.
They'd share oil revenues, but you'd leave more security issues to them and, in effect, to the militias that control there. A second approach is associated with Jim Baker and his Iraq study group. And I think the way Baker is heading is to call for an international or not, regional conference with Iraq's neighbors, including Syria and Iran, buying into some kind of stabilization. Just to make one more point, the disturbing thing about Iraq is that what the National Intelligence Estimate said a month or so ago, that the Iraq war has created a new generation of terrorists, is true. And, you know, we should not assume that as we leave, those terrorists will evaporate back into the sands of Al-Anbar province. They won't. So any solution that we try to come up with, I think, from the standpoint of U.S. security, has to think, how will a degree of security and control be maintained in the areas where those terrorist groups are operating such that they won't have a platform to come and kill us?
Mm-hmm. Giant, giant, difficult questions there. Mary is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Mary, you're on the air.
Hi. The story that's being submerged is that Israel is cleaning house politically. 2 months after the war, they want to know why the failure. They started with the army all the way up from the generals up to the president.
So sort of an account taking for what happened in Lebanon. You're saying they're doing some house cleaning in the aftermath.
Yes, only 2 months later. Mm-hmm. Now, we've been in Iraq for over 3 years. Nobody is held accountable. Reporters are writing book after book. Mm-hmm. Cobra 2 just lays it straight out. And we have to get together. I mean, the Democrats, I have no faith in those people. This is something that they should hop on right away.
Accountability for the difficult situation in Iraq. Jack, do you see that coming?
In one form. One big change that will happen if the Democrats take the House is that there will be hearings on the contracting in Iraq. I mean, serious hearings.
Is that small bore compared to the big strategic issues here?
Well,
I
was just going to get to that. And I think that the electorate will send a signal that they want, we're going to have Fulbright-like hearings going back to the 1960s on this commitment to Iraq, in which people are going to talk candidly about just how terrible our options are and about the disasters, the fatal strategy that led us into it. But we are going to hear a lot about the contracting. That's going to Henry Waxman is going to be leading it, and that's going to be real rough for the Bush administration because Halliburton is involved. Several other big campaign contributors are involved. It's going to get ugly, but the electorate is going to, that's going to be one of the factors that helps to sour people too, as they see how we have been ripped off, how the blood of our soldiers has helped, you know, sort of pay for this ripoff of the taxpayer.
We'll see how much appetite the country has for those hearings, and the Democrats have. Ann Kornblut, you've been following one Democrat in particular, Barack Obama. A lot of talk about Barack this week. He's out with a big book, Time Magazine cover, The Next President. We'll be talking with him next week. But what about the Barack phenom here? He's not exactly that kind of polarizing hearings guy, or is he?
He's not. And of course, there will be a question of what happens in the Senate if the Republicans maintain control of the Senate. Of course, John McCain, who's running for president in 2008, will be chairman of the Armed Services Committee. And the question of what he would do with hearings is still out there. Obama is not a particularly polarizing figure. If anything, you know, he's half black, he's half white. He's the kind of person that people can kind of see what they want in. And he has spent a lot of his adult life contemplating his identity and his place in America. whether he's running remains a question. There's some speculation this is all an attempt to sell books. But I think we'll know in the next couple of months. I'll be curious to see if you ask him if he's running what his answer is.
David Ignatius, we've just got a few seconds here. It looks like the Democrats are in position certainly to gain seats and maybe majorities. Do you see sort of bloody hearings, house cleaning in the Congress if that happens? Are the Democrats looking for that middle ground you described?
Well, I would love to be an optimist and say that the Democrats will do what I think would be wise, which is think about how to govern the country, spend the next 2 years coming up with programs and plans. But I mean, this is Washington, and I think we're going to see, if anything, an even nastier situation in Washington. You know, as fingers are pointed and blame is assessed, I don't think these next 2 years are going
to
be fun.
Well, there's a lot of work to be done. Let's hope it's done well. David Ignatius at the Washington Post, Ann Kornblut at the New York Times, and Jack Beatty, thanks very much to each of you for being with us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.